It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kick start it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022, and it is time to get nerdy. Welcome to episode 218 of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest gaming podcast in the universe. I am Maction, and I have my fellow nerd, connoisseur of comedy, stand-up comedian, stand-up guy, Mr. Lomgaluka, also known as Mr. Nice Guy 425. And for the next hour, we're covering topics about video gaming. We're going to talk history, we're going to talk trivia, we're going to talk lawsuits, we're going to talk it all. And we'd like to thank our returning sponsor, Game Insider Magazine. Thanks, you guys. So, Mr. Nice Guy, it's been a week, man.
It has been a week, man.
Yeah.
Oh, what happened in the past week? I got some Mardi Gras beads. Today is Mardi Gras.
I can see that. They sound delightful.
They are, and I didn't have to do the traditional thing you have to do to get beads. My wife just gave them to me, so that was kind of nice, right? I'm in my 30s. No one's trying to see that. So it was a good day, and my wife made me this fancy little drink here. It's literally cream soda with, like, vanilla flavoring, and it's just, like, a nice, unique thing. So I figured, you know what? I can't drink this all before the pod. I will finish it here on the pod in lieu of Mountain Dew.
So those of you who are here with us live, you'll be able to see Mr. Nice Guy drink a strange concoction from an odd glass. That's the kind of content that you come to the show for.
That's right. Odd drinks in odd glasses. That's a good podcast name or a good indie band name. You never know.
I've always been a fan. I was going to have a metal band called Disposable Thumbs. That was going to be my...
Not opposable, but disposable. I like it. That's clever.
Yeah.
That's
clever. Thanks.
Because really, who needs them, right?
Yeah, who needs them? It's not like it's given us any advantages. Psh. Anyway... what else has been going on?
What else has been going on, man? Not a lot, dude. I mean, this is a video game podcast, so I hate to say that I've been gaming, but I have, and it's been phenomenal. And I've really been, like, researching a lot of retro handhelds. You know, I talked in the post show last week about the Analog Pocket and how it's super hard to get and how excited I will be when it is available, because I may want to get back into Game Boy game collecting, cartridge collecting. But there's a lot of, like, emulation stuff out there that's just amazing. And maybe we'll talk about that post-show. But, like, not just, like, handheld emulation, but, like, GameCube, Wii, PlayStation 2 emulation stuff on handheld, which doesn't surprise me, but it's just cool how far we've come, man. What's new with you?
I mean, it's just kind of been a normal, you know, normal run-of-the-mill week. I've, you know, done some work on various things. Oh, Mrs. the Mac is away for this whole week on a work trip. And so I'm here all alone, and I'm living the bachelor life again. And it's just a great reminder of how unfun the bachelor life always was.
Well, I mean, let's call it like it is, dude. The bachelor life was great, but married life is better. I get what you're saying, but, like, the bachelor life had its advantages, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess. But married life is definitely better. So yeah, I miss my wife. There.
No,
there,
I totally get it. Well, the good news is, dude, we get to play GURPS on Thursday.
We do indeed.
So that'll be a Thursday night activity. And are you doing any other games this week? You DMing any other?
Yeah, let's see. I'll have something on Sunday, so I don't know if that technically counts as this week or as next week. And then I get to be a player in a D&D thing on Wednesday tomorrow. So who knows? You know, I think it's going to be a perfectly fun, exciting week. So, yeah.
On that note, I say we do what we do best and hop right into this gaming talk show. What do you think about that, Mac?
Let's do it. What's news in gaming, Mr. Nice Guy?
Dude, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, episode 218. Thank you for coming to the nerdiest video game award-winningest podcast in the galaxy. Mac, so much stuff to talk about today. I feel like we talk about the Steam Deck every week. because I am super excited for the Steam Deck to be in my hands, and I know you are as well. We're going to talk about it again today. This one is something kind of bad that happened with the Steam Deck. This is on GameSpot.com by Jessica Howard. Despite releasing just 3 days ago, Steam Deck owners are already reporting serious hardware issues with their brand new consoles, the most notable being joystick drift. Since February 25th, two separate Reddit threads have been created showcasing users with defective Steam Decks. In both instances, the console owners shared a video of their system's right joystick experiencing substantial drift. Now, Mac, I want to say this. At first, when I read this, I was irritated, but right before we hopped on the podcast, I was browsing Twitter and I saw a tweet by one Lawrence Yang, and his title on Twitter says he is design at Valve Software, previous designer at Apple, and he is obviously working for Valve. And here's what his tweet says. Hi all, a quick note about Steam Deck thumbsticks. The team has looked into the reported issues, and it turns out it was a dead zone regression from a recent firmware update. We just shipped a fix to address the bug, so make sure you're up to date. Now, number one, this is phenomenal, phenomenal customer service. There was a problem, and they addressed it quickly. But, you know, as someone who has the Steam Deck reserved, as I do, how worried are you about this being a potential issue? About, you know, a brand new piece of hardware from Valve having joystick drift, or dead pixels on the screen, or any other number of issues that comes with new hardware? Is it a concern for you?
Yes, it is a concern. However, because of the increased repairability that the Steam Deck is going to have and does have and we've seen, I am significantly less concerned than I would be about issues reported in, say, if I had, I don't know, a Nintendo Switch, which, as I'm given to understand, is significantly less repairable. However, that being said, it's one of those where it's like, you know, if I had to choose that there were issues, repairability versus non-repairability, yeah, I'd prefer repairability. I'd prefer there to be no issues at all, though.
I agree. I would prefer for there to be no issues at all, but that's just not how things work, right? That's just not how the world works. So, you know, if you're going to buy hardware and be one of the first people to buy it, you're beta testing, right? That's just the way that it works. So part of me is actually kind of excited that I'm Q2. Because I'll get to hear about all the potential issues before it's actually in my hands.
Yeah, you'll be getting it after the bugs have been worked out.
Hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's still early, but we'll see. So anyway, kudos to Valve and Lawrence Yang for handling that issue so quickly and professionally. Let's move on to our next news story on IGN.com. Now, this is about Amazon and the new Luna gaming service that is available. Let's read this by Robert Anderson. Amazon Luna is now officially available for those in the U.S. If you're an Amazon Prime member, that means you can jump into the service right now and try it out at no additional cost. But it's not all that simple. There's actually a few different ways to use Amazon Luna, and not all of them are free. Still, if you're a Prime member, feel free to head on over to Prime Gaming and check out the first few games you can stream. Otherwise, stick around while he attempts to unravel the latest cloud gaming service, Amazon Luna. We are not going to read this whole article, but there was a little infographic that I sent to Mac that kind of outlined, and I can't pull it up right now because I'm in the Discord chat with him, but it outlined all the different price tiers for different games you could get. I know that Ubisoft games were going to be like $17.99 a month to have access to them on day one. I don't know if you have it pulled up, Mac.
I do, okay. Yes. And you were spot on. Ubisoft, $17.99 a month. It is all your favorite and new release games from Ubisoft. Does that mean the entire library? Probably not, but who knows? Who knows exactly how many it is? Although, you know, you can click to see the included game.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a section for Jackbox Party games.
Yeah, Jackbox for $4.99, a Retro Channel for $4.99, a Family Channel for $2.99. a Luna Plus channel for $5.99, and then, of course, Prime Gaming free. Play a rotating selection of games free with your Prime membership.
Yeah, now for context, I tried to test this out before the pod because I wanted to see how it would work, and I was using my iPad, and it said, my iPad is 2018 iPad, just for context. It's 4 years old, but it still works perfectly well. It's updated. Would not run these games. It said my browser was out of date. So that was kind of disappointing. I'm not interested in this at all, other than the fact that I feel like I'm in the industry and I feel like I'm obligated to try it. These pricing tiers have me frustrated, though. I'm tired of being nickeled and dimed for everything. Mac, I don't know if you agree in terms of streaming services, but what are your thoughts on this, man?
Well, top line thoughts, yes, I do agree. I don't feel like this is the type of... If this is the future, I feel like it's not the type of future that I want. But I spent the time between now and then not going into this, but to look at the terms and service, because you know me. So can I throw a couple nuggets from there?
Please do.
So it claims that the last time the terms of service was updated for this was April 29th, 2021. I, of course, saw it today, March 1st. And there are a few red flags in their terms of service. The first red flag comes from the intro, making this a click-wrap agreement. Quoting directly from it, quote, "Each time you visit, browse, or use the Amazon Luna service, you agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement on behalf of yourself and all family members of your household and other users who use the service under your account." Obviously, I dislike anything that says, if you even look, you are agreeing to be bound by our terms of service agreement. That's nonsense. But, you know, oh well. Second red flag. In Article 3, you're not allowed to VPN. Now, I don't use a VPN that much, but, you know, quote, "Amazon will use technologies to verify your geographic location. You may not use any technology or technique to obscure or disguise your location." I don't know if that's a deal breaker for you. It's not really a deal breaker for me, but it's a thing.
It's not a deal breaker, but I would want to ask them why. Why do you want to know where I am located to play video games?
Mm-hmm. Why do you need to know?
And by the way, Amazon, you have my shipping address.
Yes.
So, you know, stop being ridiculous.
Yeah, you know where I am. Cut it out. A general cover your boat, but in 4i, quote, "We make no guarantee as to the resolution or quality of the digital content you will receive when streaming, even if you have paid extra for access to higher definition." Obviously, that was going to be in there. Red flag number 3, live streams from item 4J, quote, "You may not, item 3, stream, transmit, broadcast, or otherwise publicly perform any digital content except where permitted using features of this service." So it sounds like if you try to live stream playing any of these games from Luna, and you don't use a feature of the service, I don't know if that means that there's a built-in live streaming option through Luna, or could be, or might be, or will be, but you agree expressly, just by browsing the catalog of games, you've agreed that you will not stream any of the things. And it expressly says, you will not do it.
Well, that's interesting. Let's keep in mind that Amazon owns Twitch, right?
I know, right? So, and it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, who knows? And who knows? There are plenty of these provisions that in legal speak that never wind up getting, they never bring the hammer down. But again, if they want to, they can. And it's weird that we have this kind of stuff written into it.
Well, and it could be that maybe they're saying, hey, stream it on Twitch. Don't stream it anywhere else, you know? Don't stream it on Facebook. Don't stream it on YouTube. If you want to stream games from Luna, stream it on the platform that we own. It could be as simple as that.
It could be as simple as that. Is that right?
I'm not saying it's right or wrong.
Yeah, it's not right. We're not saying it's right or wrong. I'd say I'm saying it's not right. But like, you know, still nonetheless, I mean, there's a nice little thing trying to push exclusivity. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if that'll get them into hot water, but I could see maybe FCC getting you angry at you for that, but who knows? Termination, obviously from 6A, we may terminate your access to the service, including subscriptions, at our discretion without notice. Obviously, we knew that was going to happen. And here's a fun little bit from the liability in 6H. In no event shall our software licensors, shall our or our software licensors, that's like Ubisoft, anybody who put the stuff up there, shall their total liability to you for all damages arising out of or related to your use or inability to use the software exceed the amount of $50. No matter what, they are claiming our maximum liability, no matter how much money you pay us, no matter how many channels you pay for, no matter how much stuff, you agree that we are not liable for anything exceeding $50.
So when when your kid takes your credit card or logs into your Amazon account, right, because it's logged in automatically on your computer, and they subscribe to all of these different things, you cannot call Amazon and say, hey, I want my money back. More than $50.
Or you pay, I don't know how many subscriptions they have, maybe you pay, shell out $150 so that you can have them all. Like Ash Ketchum, you gotta catch them all. And then you wind up not being able to use it for reason. Or maybe they decide that they're not gonna support any of the devices that you own. And you want them to, you know, that you want them to give it back to you. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't, but they expressly state, and you expressly agree, just by the virtue of browsing the titles that they are offering you, you agree that they are not on the hook for anything more than $50. Will some of these things hold up in court? I sure as heck hope not, especially given that the agreements, click-wrap type agreements, have a somewhat rocky past with respect to being upheld. But I think it's important to note that these are the types of things that Amazon wants you to bind yourself to when you're using this service. I don't know if this is a deal breaker for anybody out there, but I think it's important to just throw that out there. Mr. Yeah. Nice Guy, you and I have both been wet blankets with respect to this, but, you know, I feel like I hope I haven't brought the mood down too much.
No, you're good, man. I mean, this isn't for me. There's like 4 games on there right now, I believe. And I think the only one I've heard of is Devil May Cry. And that's not a game that I'm particularly interested in. So this service at this point, not for me, but it does seem like they will be adding new games. That said, let's move on because there was some pretty big news. Speaking of Ash Ketchum and wanting to catch them all, as you said a few minutes ago. New Pokemon games announced for the end of 2022. Crazy to me, because we just got Pokemon Legends of Arceus. Spendus is in the chat, and I'm kind of asking him as we're streaming this what the difference is between the two. But let's start with IGN.com and Adam Banker's story. He says, the Pokemon company has announced that Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, a brand new open-world Pokemon adventure, will be released on the Nintendo Switch in late 2022. Announced during Pokemon Days 2022, Pokemon Presents, these two new Game Freak-developed games will feature a new region, and its 3 new Gen 9 starter Pokemon have already been revealed. At the beginning of the game, trainers will need to choose between the Grass Cat Sprigatito, the Fire Croc Fukoko, and the Water Duckling Quaxly. I like that. Quaxly's clever. Pokemon Scarlet and Violet are an evolutionary step for the Pokemon franchise and feature an open world where various towns with no borders blend seamlessly into the wilderness. The Pokemon Company also notes that Pokemon can be seen everywhere in this wide open world, in the skies, in the sea, and on those streets. Pokemon taken to the streets, man. Mac, we just got Pokemon Legends of Arceus. I'm kind of wanting Spenis to chime in here if he's here. Because I don't know what the difference is, but, like, that's what, like, 4 Pokemon games in a year? Too much?
Yeah, it's at the very least going to be 3 in a couple of years, maybe 4 in a couple of years.
Yeah, because I don't know if there were 2 with Arceus or not.
Can you have too much Pokemon?
I mean, and you're more into Pokemon than I am. So, you know, once you get that Steam Deck, you know, pending, like, the ability that the Steam Deck may have to do it, are you going to get into Pokemon again? Because I know you've been, like, pretty anti-Nintendo, and that's probably kept you from playing one of your favorite franchises of all time, favorite IPs.
Well, maybe. We'll see. I'm just going to have to see.
Yeah, I totally get it. So here's what Spenis has to say in the chat, because he's our local Pokemon expert. He says, I'm excited for it. Arceus did great, and this is a good game to pick up where that left off and then possibly take elements from the January release and add them into the new one. And then I said, what's the difference between Arceus and the upcoming games? He said, so far that is unknown, but Arceus is more open world. Well, it says this one's open world too. And he says the Pokemon, they can aggressively attack you. You have to send out a Pokemon to battle a wild one. Arceus is also set in more of an ancient time Pokemon-wise, back when people and Pokemon did not have the relationship like more of the modern games. That makes sense. Okay. That makes sense. Well, good to know. And you know what? For the sake of... Oh, do you have something else you want to say, Matt?
I was going to just say... Nope. I'm done.
All right. That has been our news for the week.
All right. Well, now we turn and we look into the past, this week in years that came before. And wow, I've got a couple of good ones for us. Obviously, they're the things that we always knew I was going to mention. In 2010, released for the Wii, Mega Man 10. In 2016, released for the PC, Stardew Valley. In 2017, released for the PC, Hollow Knight. Obviously, great games. If you haven't played those, you should play every one of them. But some lesser known, but I think still cool things. February 1988. Now, I didn't have a more exact date than just February, so we're doing it now since we're, you know, last week was still the last little bit of February.
Sure.
The release of Contra for the NES. So, Mr. Nice Guy,
yes,
Contra
sir.
Is the first place I ever learned to use the Konami code.
Of course, me too.
You too. And it wasn't until many years later that I ever learned to play it and beat it without the Konami code. Thanks in no small part to my speedrunning brethren who were kind enough to give me help on that regard. But Contra always seemed strange to me in a lot of ways. It was an improvement on, like, other games. Like, it seemed very much in advance to me. And I learned that there was an interesting trick with collision detection that Contra did. So, in video games, right, Mr. Nice Guy, we tend to have hitboxes, right?
Sure.
Yeah, and that determines collision mechanics. So when is something going to actually kill you or whatever? And there are those times where maybe the hitbox isn't drawn absolutely correct, and so you get, like, you know, things just pass through or whatever. Contra actually goes for an incredibly simple method of collision detection. It doesn't draw boxes at all. As far as the video game is concerned, the player is a single point hitbox. But the size of the hitbox for enemy projectiles change depending upon your state, whether the character is standing up, lying down, or in a jump, so that the NES didn't actually have to math hitboxes in on the player side. It just had to math an offset on a pixel as the projectile was coming in, which is one of these early kind of cool tricks. It just absolutely blew my mind. And although it's one thing to hear me say that, and that's kind of like word salad, there are some videos on YouTube where you can watch where, like, they'll show you where the hitbox detection is and everything.
Sure.
On Contra. You owe it to yourself to watch that, because it is a trip and it is beautiful. But anyway, that's Contra.
Yeah, I have good memories of Contra. Like, I remember going to my friend's house as a kid, and I remember his mom took us to McDonald's. I was like, dope, this is gonna be a fun day. And we went back to his house and we're playing Contra and we're dying and we're dying and we're dying. And he's like, Mom, can you enter the Konami code? And I was like, wait, what's the Konami code? And his mom was like, sure. And so she took like three or four tries and entered it in. And he was like, now we have infinite lives. And I was like, what? And it just like blew my mind. I was like, first of all, how does your mom know how to do this? Like, my mom knows how to play Mario and she's great at it. And my mom was the coolest mom ever. But I had never heard of this Konami code because I did not have Contra. So that was just like a revolutionary moment for me, that game makers would make cheats in a game to make it easier, but also, like, it's kind of like an easy mode mm-hmm. like nowadays, right? Like an accessibility thing. Because those NES games were so hard. So it's my memory of Contra.
There's hard and then there's Nintendo hard. But man, thanks for that. Let's see. Next one. February 28th, 2005. Fight Night Round 2.
Okay.
Release for the GameCube. It was a fighting game, right?
Yeah.
By all accounts, nothing particularly interesting about this game, except the guy who was responsible for it. But for that to, you know, make sense, let's hop back just a little bit, right?
Get in that time machine.
Do you remember in the early 90s a Nintendo emulator called Nesticle? Of course. It was the 90s. This emulator was about as mature as we were at the time. The pointer was a severed hand with blood dripping off of it. You know, I mean, it was the 90s. Well, the dude who made that emulator in the late 90s, he became a serious game developer, right? And he was actually working on Fight Night Round 2. And so in Fight Night Round 2, you can actually play Super Punch-Out. You can unlock it inside of the game. And here's where it gets awesome.
I did not know this.
Here's where it gets great, because you notice, of course, that Super Punch-Out is a Super Nintendo game.
Yes.
What he did was he built Snesticle, an SNES emulator, and embedded it inside of the game Fight Night Round 2. And it plays Super Punch-Out basically almost perfectly. Dude was legit, he was cool. Now, Snesticle never actually received a release. So the only way that you can get your hands on it, technically, I guess, is if you were to extract the data from Fight Night Round 2. And it's probably nowhere near as good as the other Super Nintendo emulators, but at the time when the world needed him most, the creator of Nesticle vanished and showed up years later in 2005. There. You know what? I had another couple, but in interest of time, I think I've kept us long enough. We'll end on Long Live Nesticle.
Well, you know, we've been kind of a retro game kick lately. And I want to share something for the topic of the week today that is about retro games and about the whole idea of games being lost in time, and maybe never even experienced by the general public. This is on GameInformer.com, written by Wesley LeBlanc. It's about Virtual Boy. Mac, did you ever get to experience Virtual Boy? I never owned one. I don't know anyone who had one. Did you ever get to try it?
I got to experience it once. It wasn't my favorite thing in the world. However, the Virtual Boy had this thing where it would bounce a wedge-shaped mirror, flap it back and forth in order to create the images on either side, give that of the left and right, and give those illusions of depth and three dimension. It was actually quite interesting, because when I was taking which class would it have been? Instrumental analysis, one of the higher level chemistry ones, which went into depth about how various equipment did what they did in a chemistry laboratory.
Okay.
One of the things that was funny is that that was essentially what would be called a beam splitter. And I remember hearing about how that was done, and I'm just like, oh, just like the Virtual Boy. Okay, cool. Understood. Check for comprehension. Anyway, not important. So your question again was yes, I have tried.
Yeah. So I played it maybe once, and I feel like I tried it at a local game store or a Sears or something, where they just had one on display.
Man, a Sears. Those were the days.
They used to sell video games at Sears, legitimately. I remember emptying my piggy bank one time with my brother and buying a Super Nintendo game of the series, but that's another story for another time. So anyway, here's this article. It's funny the tangents we get on. A Virtual Boy F-Zero spinoff game called Zero Racers was done, according to a former Nintendo producer. However, as anyone who's ever looked into history of this spinoff knows, Zero Racers, sometimes known as G-Racers, was never released. This likely had less to do with the game and more to do with Virtual Boy's commercial failure. Yes, the Virtual Boy has garnered a fan base over the past few decades, but at the end of the day, it wasn't a success. That lack of success likely led to games like Zero Racers never becoming a reality, or so we thought, because it turns out Zero Racers was complete and ready to play. Zero Racers was done, former Nintendo of America localizer and associate producer Jim Warnell told Did You Know Gaming, as reported by Nintendo Life. We had a complete manual, package, and label done for the game. It went through the lot check. It had an ESRB rating. It was complete. He also said that it was never going to have F-Zero in the title, although it was set in the same universe as the famed Nintendo Racing franchise. Zero Racers was showcased not once, but twice in the now-defunct Nintendo Power magazine, complete with screenshots that showed off the tunnel-like nature of the game. It looks more like a Star Wars Death Star run than a racing game. Mac, so many games lost to, I don't even know what to say, like just lost, simply because the console failed, or they couldn't get funding, or there were legal issues. And we've seen that sometimes these games can be brought back to life. When the Super Nintendo Mini came out, they released that second Star Fox game, right? And it was part of it, it had never been released before. Like, don't you think that Nintendo would benefit from releasing these games at least virtually? Or do you think there's a good reason for why they choose to just let them die and all that work to go to waste?
Oh, man. Gosh. Mr. Nice Guy, you know how to ask a loaded question that you know exactly how I'm going to answer.
I don't know how you're going to answer.
I don't believe that for a second, you wily, incorrigible man, you.
I don't.
Look, video games are artwork, Mr. Nice Guy. It's not only a labor of hundreds of people, at the very least tens of people's man hours over the course of years to try and craft something that might be fun or in some cases tell a story, but it's also a work of art that is best appreciated and experienced. I mean, I believe that in the depths of my soul. So like,
but let me add a clarification, because okay, we're not talking about a game that used to be on PC or on console where the servers were shut down, right? We're not talking about a game that was released previously and now they're shutting down the eShop and we'll have no way to play that game anymore. We're talking about a game that doesn't have any type of following, that is just a sunken cost in their mind, and that we'll never get to experience. And so what I'm saying is, in that situation where we have no idea if it's good or bad, do they stand to profit from releasing?
And what I'm saying is, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear, does it still make a sound? Because it's like, you know, immaterial, the art, you know, that part of things, the thing that gets at my heartstrings is just that, you know, nobody's experienced it. And yet this thing existed, featured Nintendo Power twice. I think, yes, I 100% want Nintendo to release this. Even if I never have the capabilities or the ability to play it, I want somebody out there to experience this work, the work of those people who put their time and their heart into it. And I mean, but I guess at the end of the day, how much would it have to bring in for it to be worth it to Nintendo? Would it be worth it for them to bother?
Well, there was that, this reminds me, there was that documentary on Netflix and I can't remember the name of it now. Oh man, but it was about video games. And
was it High Score?
Yes, it was High Score. And there was like four or five episodes. And I don't know if you got to watch the whole thing, but one of the episodes was about a guy, one of the guys, I believe he created D&D. And he had also created a game on disc that was lost and that he didn't even have a copy of. I don't know if you remember this, but he was like searching for his whole life to find a copy of this game because it was pretty much eliminated from existence. And, you know, he'd come and he'd find someone who supposedly had a copy of it and would say, hey, can I please come, you know, copy this so I can get it? I don't know if you remember this and if I'm telling this correctly, but it's sad. Like, it's sad that a game could be created and that it could be lost forever and that all the people who put time and energy into it would never be able to see it again because they don't own the rights to it. It's like when you work for a company, you'll sign a thing that says anything you create using these company resources is property of the company. And I can't help but think that that's probably what happened here.
Yeah, and it is sad, but I hope that it comes out. I'd love to see it. Even if it doesn't bear the name F-Zero, I still think it's probably worth it. And I don't know what we have these days for respect to playing Virtua Boy games if you don't have a Virtua Boy, but there's got to be some way to make it happen.
I mean, there's got to be a way to play it just without the virtual aspect, right? Like play it on a Game Boy emulator. I'm sure it would work. It's going to be all red, but I'm sure it would work, right? Put it out on the eShop and let us play it on the Switch. So that has been our topic of the week.
All right. Well, now we turn to a crowdfunding effort that's trying to get off of the ground. I've posted a link in the chat. Mr. Nice Guy, this is a little something called John Carter, Warlord of Mars. All right, so let's start here. John Carter, not exactly one of the one of our childhood themes, right? Not exactly somebody that we hear a lot. There was a, I guess, flop that Disney did a few years back called John Carter, trying to bring that up. And I think the original comic book was, or the original novel was set in the late 1800s, but it was itself written in the early 1900s.
Now, are you thinking of Agent Carter?
No, I'm thinking John Carter.
There's a John Carter from Disney? Interesting.
Yeah, John Carter. And in it, he, spoiler alert, goes to Mars. Right? That's I'm pretty sure how it goes.
Oh, cool.
So these guys are trying to make a video game. Their goal is roughly $500,000 to bring the game to market. And it's a $45 million entry.
Wait, what?
Sorry, $45 minimum entry.
Oh. Oh.
Sorry, I might have said because $500,000 is what I have writ there.
Got it.
But yeah, in order to get a copy of this game for the Kickstarter, $45 is your minimum buy-in. Sounds great, right?
No.
It's listed as delivery for November 2022 delivery. Yep, this is my reaction. This is sheer fantasy, all right? So as you guys are looking over this, let's just break down some of the challenges that might obviously be. This is already an intellectual property that exists, and it's an IP that not that long ago Disney did a thing with. Now, they claim that they have negotiated the rights with the original IP holders in order to make this. They are going to have Hypnotic Ants be the game devs, which is a studio with one game currently released and one game pending. And these are the people who are supposed to be doing the developing. So who on earth is doing the Kickstarter? Well, it's a PR firm, apparently. Another interesting thing about this, the studio, Hypnotic Ants, has 9 employees. It currently has job openings posted for 2 people as well. So that's 11. But they say that they are going to have 25 full-time employees working on this project, and that's why they need $500,000 to do it. So is the game developer going to double in size to do this? I just have a lot of questions when a PR company is just like, give us $500,000, pay $45 for a Kickstarter game, and I just don't understand what they're going for. They don't even give us any in-engine rendered content from what I can see. And obviously there's no playable demo of this. So while this is probably one of the more polished Kickstarters that I've seen that instantly turns me off, it does instantly turn me off for all these reasons and more. I'm sorry for dominating the conversation here, Mr. Nice Guy.
No, it's fine, man.
But, like, you know, what are your top line thoughts here?
Yeah, so someone said something in the NFT space recently. I saw a tweet where they said, beware of projects where people are better salesmen than they are producers. Like,
ooh,
actually being able to.
That's good.
Yeah, like actually being able to execute on the roadmap. And this seems like that, because if you don't even have all the employees hired for your company yet, and you're planning on delivering this Kickstarter project by November of this year, that means that you think you are going to be able to hire all of the people that you need to do this, and then say, hey, by the way, we're working on a Kickstarter that's due in 6 months, you know, from the time we hire you. And it needs to be ready to go. And there's no playable demo at this point. So I think that these people are delusional. And I guess I could go on and on about why, but I think I got my point across.
Yeah. I'd say kick it. Absolutely delusional. There is something about this whole process that either strikes me as being horribly unaware, which is a huge red flag for a company that's supposed to be a PR company that's supposed to specialize in video games and such like that. If you don't know how this works, find yourself a new PR company, because this seems to be like a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of Kickstarter, of projects, of how these things work. And it makes me wonder. It's one of those things where it's like, is this so bad? Is this, you know, just ineptitude, or is this something more insidious? Is the type of stuff that I wonder.
$500,000 is a lot of money for a Kickstarter. Yeah. It really is. Like the one that I just kickstarted with Mina the Hollower with Yacht Club Games. And by the way, Yacht Club Games has made Shovel Knight, and awesome games. Like, they're reputable. Their Kickstarter just hit $1 million with like a day or two left. So, I mean, and they're known. They're a known entity, and you know the game is going to be good. So the idea that someone who is not that would ask for half as much money to me is crazy.
Half as much money and double and a half as much for a copy as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I guess we've kicked them to the curb enough there.
Yeah,
that's been kick or kickstart, and I just do want to throw out there again that it's like 25 employees. That number like hit like alarm bells. I'm just like, why? And then the indie studio has 9 employees. Are all these other employees going to be for your PR firm, or are they going to be for the indie devs, or why?
Although here's what I'll say in response to that. I got to say, Cave Story was made by one dude, right? Now, that's not common, and also that game can be had on the internet for free. But I mean, he did the music. He did it all. That's a rarity, but there are some hidden gems that succeed in that space. This is not that. But it has been done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I'm not saying that it couldn't be. What I'm saying is the team already had X number of people, and it's like, are you really going to put all that money? It just left me with questions is really what I'm
saying. Yeah, agreed.
But anyway, that has been kick or kickstart.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for Nerdflex.
Woo-hoo.
A segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts. And sometimes you come close. Mac, we have some questions pulled up in the test bank. But for those of you that are here live, if you have multiple choice gaming-related questions, get those in the chat. And I see that we already have one here from our good friend AlexMan47. I will read this. And those rest of you that are here live, get those questions in the chat. We'll try to answer them. No use of Google. No cheating. Just putting our noggins together. Alex Mann asks, which cane of the Zelda series protects you from harm and can damage enemies? The cane of Samaria, the cane of Berna, or the cane of Patchy?
Okay, so I am familiar with a cane in Link to the Past. I seem to recall that it would create a block, and I think you could get it to like explode and damage other enemies and damage
which,
enemies.
In which game was this?
Link to the Past. Link to the Past. Yep, that's the one for Super Nintendo. And I'm pretty sure that was the cane of Samaria. But I feel like there was a cane that protect you from harm that, like, you could use as well in Link to the Past that would, like, make it so you could run across spikes. Like, there were some floors that just had, like, a bunch of spikes that would pop up. And was that a cane as well that you used so that you could run across?
I gotta replay that game. Because I honestly don't remember.
Well, Cane of Samaria is a name that I remember.
Me too. That was my first instinct.
Yeah, and it's my first instinct as well. But I just don't know for sure. So as long as it's both of our first instinct, I say let's go for it. Final answer, number one, Cane of Samaria.
Let us know in the chat, Alex Mann, if that is correct. And once we get that answer, Mac will go ahead and read our second question in just a sec.
But it's a great question because I feel like, I feel like it could be any of those.
Yeah, we don't get enough Zelda questions, so good job, Alex.
Oh, the correct answer was two. The Cane of Bynra creates a force field around Link, making him invincible from attacks or traps. The force field damages enemies if they make contact with Link. Cane of Samaria makes a block that can hold down buttons and can damage enemies, but doesn't protect Link. Okay.
You were right about it making a block.
Yeah, and the Cane of Pachi flips objects in front of Link. So, great question. All right, the second question for tonight comes from Spenis the Menace. He asks, in the Mario Party franchise, which one was the first to contain story mode? Was it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8? And I have basically no idea.
I would guess 3 would be my first instinct.
Okay.
You know, you make one and it does well. So the second one, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But then for the third one, you want to try something different. You want to add a new mode. You want to keep people excited. So that would be my guess would be 3 or 4, but I lean towards 3.
All right. And I have absolutely no inclination. So let's go for number 3.
Let us know in the chat. And if anyone wants to get a third question in, feel free to get that third multiple choice gaming related question in the chat right now. Otherwise, we'll hit up the test bank, which is totally cool. And we'll get a question from there.
Ah, Mr. Nice Guy, your instincts were spot on. Spenis says it is Mario Party 3. It was a bit more extensive, as you had a 4-player map followed by a dual map. Mario Party 4 simplified it with having a 4-player map and then a story-based minigame. Both did have a finishing minigame to the story mode. 1 and 2 did have minigame map, was a minigame map type of mode, though. So we got it right with Mario Party 3. Congrats, Mr. Nice Guy.
Fantastic. So, lucky guess. But yeah. I used logic, so we'll take credit for that. So now we're 1 for 2. Let's get that third question. In the Half-Life games, who is the sinister interdimensional bureaucrat?
Oh, the G-Man.
I feel like that's too easy of a question.
We'll
take it. We choose him randomly. There's a random button. G-Man, final answer. And it is the G-Man.
Do you wanna click another random one? Because that one was too easy.
Nah, you know what? We're good. We got one wrong. We had some tough ones today. So that has been Nerdflex, everyone.
All right. Well, now we turn to a little bit of legalese.
Legalese.
And I am not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. And today we are going to talk about some intellectual property. As you know, intellectual property law is often what is the greatest interface with video games. And so today, we're talking about the case of Steven Thaler and the Creativity Machine. Mr. Nice Guy, I don't know if you knew this, but AI products cannot be copyrighted.
Did not know that.
Yeah. AI products can't be copyrighted. And this is something that goes back a few years. There was a picture of there's a dude, he set up a camera, right? And he left a camera and one of those buttons that you click to take pictures. And there was a monkey that took a selfie. This was, I want to say mid-2000s or so. And it wound up being the case that that got circulated. The guy who took the photo was just like, hey, that's my picture. But he wasn't allowed to assert copyright over the photo because he didn't actually take it. It may have been his equipment, it may have been his stuff, but it was the monkey that grabbed the thing and took his own picture. The monkey took the selfie. So the photographer, air quotes, he couldn't do that. And this was much of the stuff that was sort of precedential for the idea that would later come about when people started doing AI-related projects. Now, shortly after our last show, the Copyright Office denied the registration of a two-dimensional artwork with the Copyright Office. In 2018, this guy, Stephen Thaler, he made a program called the Creativity Machine, which turned out a piece of art. The AI made the art, and he claimed it as a work for hire. He said, I hired the AI that built that he had built to make the art. And in 2019, the Copyright Office said no, because it, quote, lacks the human authorship necessary to support a copyright claim. So, AI products can't be copyrighted. But where does the line fall? What about that stuff that's like, you know, an AI drew a thing and you right. modify it? Probably copyrightable because, like, it has some amount of human authorship, but we don't know for sure yet. What about, I'm sure you've seen those Twitter things occasionally. It was like, I forced an AI to watch 100 hours of blank, and then it wrote a script. Is that enough human authorship? I suspect that probably wouldn't work, because I imagine it's basically about the same. As a matter of fact, I suspect that his creativity machine, he probably fed a bunch of pictures to produce the eventual artwork. So, anyway, I guess what I'm getting at here, this whole, you know, ball of wax, is that the headline takeaway is that no one should be able to come after us for our current background music, which is AI-generated background music on our tracks, that I don't have to credit anybody for, and that nobody should come for us. So, that has
Although
been
our intro music made by a talented
Sleeping
musician.
With Spiders. Yes, indeed. And he gets credit every single episode in the things, because yes, that's... But the background, the general background stuff that you hear... AI generated. So, yeah, don't come at us. And that's our show.
Well, it's time for my favorite, one of my favorite segments before we wrap. And by the way, that was dope, Mac. It made me think about, you know, legally, what about games that have procedurally generated levels, right? Like, I mean, yes, the person wrote the program to make it that way, but is it technically the AI that's generating those levels?
Well, the thing is, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm definitely not an AI lawyer, but I would probably say that procedurally generated is not close enough to the AI generation, you know, network generation, because you make the program to do a specific thing, whereas he was claiming that he could get the copyright on it, he hired the AI to do the thing. Whereas a procedural generation is a component of the code that you made. So I think that's where they'd probably come down on it. They'd probably still give you the thing, because it's like, you know, it's just the procedural generation's just a part.
Yeah, because there's a lot of other stuff that goes into it, right?
Yeah, rather than this design. Artwork, which was just one thing, just the art.
Well, cool. Now it's time for one of my favorite segments called What We've Been Watching and What We've Been Playing, where we talk about just that, the cool, nerdy stuff that we have been into across all gaming platforms, across all streaming mediums, physical and digital. So, Mac, what you been playing, what you been watching? Oh, by the way, if you're here live, you got a job to do. Let us know in the chat what you've been into. Mac, what have you been into?
Well, I've been rewatching some Better Call Saul in preparation for the new season that's coming out. Also have been watching Marvelous Miss Maisel. That has a new season, so I've been rewatching the previous season just to, you know, get that fresh in the mind. And that's about it for watching. As for playing, I've mostly just been playing Hyper Light Drifter. And if I'm completely honest, Mr. Nice Guy, I have some thoughts and some feelings.
Please.
You want me to do this now?
Sure, give us the elevator pitch.
Right. So, Hyper Light Drifter. An interesting, fairly enjoyable game. I liked it. With the exception of some very small concessions in order to tell you in basically the intro level, oh, hey, this button does this, this button does that. Once you get through that, there is no text, no dialogue. Everything's told visually. You talk to someone, you get screens, you get images with them telling you essentially what their path and journey has been. Very interesting. Very interesting. And I really liked it. Maybe I'll talk some more about it in the post show, but really enjoyed Hyper Light Drifter.
Yeah, I wanna know some more about it. So tell me in the post show, because it's been on my backlog in terms of games, like on my wish list for a long time. So cool. As far as what I've been playing, it's been a lot of Horizon Forbidden West. That game is fire. I'm loving it. Really, really good. And that's pretty much what I've been playing. I think I got a little bit of Call of Duty in just to burn off some steam. Oh, and I played a little bit of Halo. I had never tried it on PC. I have this killer PC that I barely ever use for high fidelity games like that. So I tried it on PC and it was great. In terms of what I've been watching, a little bit more Arcane on Netflix. And I think I mentioned last week that I saw Uncharted. I don't know if I did or not. And a ton of YouTube, man. I've literally been reading about retro collecting and watching about retro collecting on YouTube. Because I like something about collecting old Game Boy games really gets me excited. I've never played through Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, and I feel like it's a major hole in my gaming history. So I want to play through those. And I believe that is it for me, Mac. What are people into in the chat?
Let's see. Spenis is watching just the usual and waiting for things to come out. Galvatron's been binging the Marvel Netflix stuff before they leave Netflix. Free Guy and All of Us Are Dead. As for what people are playing, we've got Spenis with MLB The Show and has even been playing that with Ruckus and has been playing Mario Kart with Alex Man. And Galvatron's been playing Elden Ring and Cyberpunk 2077, as well as Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy, Game of the Year candidate last year, I believe, coming out to Game Pass on the 10th, y'all, which I think is unbelievable. So I'm excited. But Mac, why don't you take us home?
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for coming out to episode 218. We hope to see you next week. Same time, same place. Keep it nerdy, everybody. And we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye. See ya.